Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Glad you're with us today. Happy October 31st. Today is the 500th anniversary of when Martin Luther nailed a list of grievances against the Catholic Church onto a door of a chapel in Wittenberg, Germany. His 95 theses became the catalyst for the Protestant Reformation. So he nailed them up 500 years ago, and just last week they finished reading them. You know how that goes? Somebody's got 95 ideas. It's like, who's got time for all that, huh? Anyway, that is going to be a subject that we're going to have on the show today. We're going to have quite an interesting discussion about the Protestant Reformation. We have Dr. Mark Muska is going to be coming on the show and all kinds of other interesting guests. And in just a few minutes, we're going to have Rob Bluey come on the show. He's the editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. We're going to talk about all the things that are going on in Washington. So that will be an interesting conversation as well. And I was a little restless last night. I had trouble sleeping, so I flipped on the TV. And because it's that time of the year, they had Nightmare on Elm Street Part 5 on. Part 5, who's still living on this block? Move to Oak Street. Do something. That's just a weird neighborhood. All right, take control of your life. All right. And also, it's a Harry Houdini's anniversary of his death. He died at age 52. Imagine all he did and his escapes, and then he gets punched in the stomach by somebody, and he has a ruptured appendix and appendicitis and dies. What a weird way to go. All right. 6 minutes after the hour, Rob Bluey is already on the line. We'll be back in just a minute.
It's morning. The good part, that's up to you. With a little help from Bill Arnold and the Early Morning Late Show on Faithmaker.
Good morning, it's 7 minutes after the hour. I was the smartest guy in the room, and then Rob Bluey had to come in. Wreck all the fun. Rob is editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal and a frequent guest of the show. Rob, good morning.
Good morning.
And how are you today?
Doing well today. It's a big week in Washington. Of course, the news yesterday centered around Robert Mueller's investigation and some of the first charges coming out. Today, we have the big three technology companies, Google, Facebook, and Twitter on Capitol Hill testifying. And then tomorrow we're going to see our first glimpse of the tax reform bill.
Wow,
so no shortage of news in Washington this week.
Yeah. So, Rob, a guy from the right colludes with a guy from the left. One becomes a short-term manager of a presidential campaign, and one is a brother of a guy who's the manager of another presidential campaign. Should I be following the money here?
Well, it seems that this investigation that Mueller is running is touching people regardless, as you say, of political party or connections. But yeah, they two prominent people, Paul Manafort and Tony Podesta. Of course, Manafort, the former campaign manager for Trump, and Podesta, the brother of Hillary Clinton's campaign manager, both yesterday in the news for their roles and possible connections here. And you know, it's really one of those things where you have to wonder where this is going to end. Yesterday was just the beginning, the first grand jury indictments that we've seen. And you're right, this might drag well into 2018, and that's probably not good news for the establishment of either political party in Washington.
Yeah, Rob. Now, former Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton says it's time for Congress to do their jobs to hold President Trump accountable. And I'm choking on my own rage here.
Well, of course, yes. Now, remember, there are still some members of Congress who want to hold Hillary Clinton accountable for her actions as Secretary of State, and they're still pursuing some investigations and trying to get to the bottom of some of the documents that that haven't been released yet. So, but that's another matter, maybe for another time. Look, I think that what you're seeing right now is an effort on the part of Democrats to try to galvanize their supporters and their base so they can retake control of the House. And you better believe it, one of the first things that they would do if they had control of the U.S. House of Representatives is to launch an impeachment of President Trump. In fact, there are Democrats already in the House who have, you know, introduced the articles of impeachment. So if Republicans were to lose control of the House next year, you better believe that that is something that they're very likely to pursue. And I think that's one of the reasons you have Hillary Clinton and others saying saying such things.
All right. Now, all of this money that the DNC spent trying to get dirt on President Trump, then candidate Trump, they probably just assumed, and I'm guessing this is just my speculation, that none of this would matter because once Madam President gets in office, it's all going to be covered up. It's all going to be taken care of. There's going to be no trails.
Well, that's right. I mean, first of all, there probably would just be not nearly the level of interest on the part of the news media. So what's fueling a lot of these stories are a desire on the part of the news media to, you know, to keep it alive because, you know, frankly, it probably on the one hand is good ratings, and on the other hand, there's an element of investigative journalism here. And so, were Hillary Clinton the president, you're right. There probably just wouldn't be the level of interest, and some of these disclosures would have never come out. Yeah, it's, you know, Fusion GPS, which is the firm that produced this dossier on President Trump, which we found out last week, was funded in part by the Clinton campaign and Democrats. You know, it's a messy business, and it's one of the reasons I'm glad I'm on the other side because, you know, as journalists in Washington, oftentimes there are these operatives who are trying to plant stories, and particularly in the world of politics, which is why I'm so glad that I get to focus on policy and not the election campaigns.
Right.
Because there was a time when I did that, and I remember distinctly about 10 years ago when I was covering some races, the amount of you know, opposition research and negative information that's out there about these candidates is just alarming, and there are a lot of people peddling it, and you better believe that that's where a lot of these stories come from. It's not journalists doing the work on their own. It's some operative like Fusion GPS feeding them information that they've dug up.
All right, speaking of that, now this next story, I don't care much about the story, but I'm very excited to say this guy's name, and that's George Papadopoulos.
That's right.
Oh, that was fun. You can say it if you like.
George Papadopoulos.
There we go. Yes. I wonder if he knows George Stephanopoulos.
Well, this is an individual who was an unpaid volunteer on the Trump campaign. I believe did some foreign policy work and ended up lying to federal investigators. And so now he also finds himself ensnared and tied up in this whole situation. So, of course, the headline of the Washington Post, you know, five column banner headline today is three Trump campaign officials charged, which is, you know. You know, as the president, I think, was trying to say yesterday, and Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the spokeswoman, was trying to say, obviously they didn't tell George Papadopoulos to lie to investigators, and some of the behavior, some of the things that Manafort's being charged for happened before he was, you know, campaign chairman and whatnot. So, you know, a variety of things taking place in this case, and again, these are just three. There could be more coming.
When is it ever a good idea to lie to the FBI?
Never. Please. I'm not a lawyer, but I think that your listeners
have to be a lawyer to know that's the answer.
Yeah, it's just common sense, right?
Yeah. Now, if you're Paul Manafort and you're starting to funnel money, I mean, was he working in Ukraine at the time, and was he has probably access to all kinds of corruption, and he couldn't resist? What was the deal there?
Well, look, it's hard to know somebody's motives, and I, you know, I can't speculate,
right.
You know, as to what was going on and why he was doing it. I just think that, you know, it's one of those situations where it's really unfortunate that with so many other pressing issues that we should be confronting, you know, this is going to dominate the news this week. In some cases, maybe that works to President Trump's advantage. Would you rather have them focused on Manafort and Mueller, and then maybe, they're not paying less attention to tax reform, and the Democrats are distracted and won't be, ginning up their base to oppose what we expect to be a really good plan and one that is probably going to pass on a pretty razor-thin margin. So, this is the media environment that we live in today. And a colleague of mine, Lee Edwards, whose father was a longtime journalist at the Chicago Tribune and is the historian of the conservative movement, was talking about how, this Russia's propaganda and disinformation efforts go back decades. I mean, they go back to the time when he was getting his start in journalism in the 1960s. And he was recalling stories of the 1960 presidential election and meddling efforts back then. So this is not something new that Russia has attempted to do. And they will look for people in the U.S. political system that they can try to use as leverage to advance their agenda and interests.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you follow the money and you find out that Paul Manafort spent $685,000 on his landscaping at his house in the Hamptons, I'm starting to go, huh, that's a pretty liberal budget.
That's the one thing about Washington. There are a lot of special interests, a lot of people who will try to manipulate others and get paid a lot of money for it.
Yeah.
And I think it's unfortunate that people choose that path in life rather than perhaps doing some other good things.
I'm also going to be suspicious if your toilets flush Perrier water. Anyway, we'll take a break and be back. It's 16 minutes after the hour. Talking to Rob Bluey, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Be right back.
One, two, three, four.
No.
Devil ain't lazy.
No, sirree.
Devil ain't lazy.
No, sirree.
No, sirree.
He
roams around with sticks and stones. Passing out his moans and groans.
That makes me smile. Pokey LaFarge. All right, back. Talking to Rob Bluey, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. Let's see, Rob, where I last left off was a little housekeeping business. We like all of our regular guests to have their own theme song when they come on the show. So you have to pick out a song for you.
Okay, well, let me give that some thought.
Yeah, you definitely.
I'll let you know next week.
Yeah, so all of a sudden the theme song plays and everybody goes, hey, Rob Bluey's going to be on. So we'd like to connect that with a song you like, just walk-up music, just like in baseball.
Okay,
Cool. Now, the Virginia church that George Washington attended, I guess we're going to tear out a memorial because the plaque could make some worshipers feel unsafe or unwelcome.
That's right.
What up with that?
One of those stories that, we've been covering this at the Daily Signal, not just this particular church, but this ongoing debate taking place in our country. This heated up again around Columbus Day earlier this month. And now, literally just down the road from where I live and work, you have the church in the city of Alexandria, Virginia, where George Washington was a parishioner, saying that, they're going to remove this memorial to him. And I think it's really, on the one hand, it's like one of those head-scratching moments where you just don't get it. First of all, everyone, particularly in the Washington, D.C. area, which, of course, is named for George Washington, holds him in such high reverence. We have Mount Vernon, his estate where he lived, which is a popular destination for tourists coming in from out of town, as well as local residents. We live on one of George Washington's five farms. That's the area all around Mount Vernon, and it's really quite sad when it reaches this level where this church has decided to take this action.
How come we just don't say no?
Well, but in this case, as I understand it, it was the vestry of the church. It's an Episcopal church, and it was the members of this church who are elected by their parishioners who made the decision. So it wasn't, it's not being imposed by some government agency
Okay.
or some bureaucrat. It's the it's the church itself which is making this decision. So maybe it's, you know, I think this, I don't worship there, so I mean, I again can't speak to the specifics of why individual members may have felt this way, but I can't imagine the entire congregation is in support of this. And I think in some cases you probably have some people who look at some of the national conversations that are taking place and, you know, saw, yes, maybe that, as you said, that it makes some people feel unwelcome and, let's remove it because, heaven forbid, you know, we don't want to offend anybody by George Washington once having a presence in our building.
And today, Rob, is, in 1941, Mount Rushmore was completed. Is it time we get George Washington off that mountain?
Look, there is no end to this quest on the part of the left in America to rewrite history and wipe out some of the individuals who are, whether they're the founding fathers or have made significant contributions to the history of this country. And I think it's one of those things where they're either so ashamed by what has taken place, or they simply, you know, disagree so vehemently with the founding principles of our country and want to take us in a different direction that this is one of the ways that they do it. If they can make our founders, so toxic and disliked, then, you know, the ideas that they stood for will hopefully follow, I think, in their view. And that's unfortunate. It's really a shame. It's one of the reasons why I think, you know, parents need to be so assertive and closely monitoring what's being taught in schools, particularly, you know, public schools. We who believe in those founding principles need to stand by and you know, educate the next generation about why they are so important.
Makes very little sense to me. Why don't we start banning country music from the Grand Ole Opry while we're at it?
Well, and Bill, I think the other piece here is you're going to have a situation on Capitol Hill this week where Republicans and Democrats are going to be putting Facebook, Twitter, and Google under the microscope for, again, Russia and what kind of Russia connections were happening on these platforms during the election. These platforms, whether you like them or dislike them as a way to communicate, have been the one of the greatest efforts in American history to democratize information and give the American people a greater voice in the political process. The political establishment in Washington and the establishment media does not like that because they would prefer to go back to a day where they control all the information and the American people don't have the opportunity to connect with friends or family or publish on their own. And so there's going to be attempts to regulate them. And again, I think it goes to the core of our founding principles. Do we believe in the freedom of speech and the freedom of the press, or, you know, do we want to regulate that away?
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that there was not a ton of money spent on the Facebook ads for this last presidential campaign. I think it was $150,000, but I think I heard yesterday that as many as up to 120 million people were either saw or had some exposure to these ads. That's a lot of bang for your buck. I mean, because Hillary spent $1.4 billion and still lost?
Well, and so yes, and just to clarify a point there. So from what I understand, the 126 million number, there's a few caveats to that. First of all, that was that's not necessarily the ads. That's including some of the free content that they posted as well.
Okay.
So and also, as Facebook acknowledged, which you're not seeing reported, is that that's the maximum number that they say could have been exposed, but they do not know if the people had been logged in on those days, if they had seen the content in their news feed. So, again, I think that you're going to see that big number today come out. I just ask your listeners to be mindful. Look at some of the details. Look at what the Facebook representative actually says on Capitol Hill, because, again, this is a story that the news media has an interest in seeing continue throughout the next 3.5-4 years during the Trump presidency, because they seem to be, insistent on developing this narrative about Russian meddling in the election, and that there was some sort of collusion on the part of President Trump, despite his repeated denials of such. And if they can use Facebook and bring down Twitter and Google in the process, I think that that ultimately does more of a harm to American democracy in the long run. We should be, as consumers, demanding greater transparency on the part of these companies, but I don't think that we need to be passing laws to further regulate freedom of speech or political speech.
Yeah, Rob, I love your perspective. Thank you so much for being on the program. And next time you're on, you will have your own theme song. Look forward to that.
Great.
Thanks,
Thank
Rob.
You, Bill.
Yep, Rob Bluey, editor-in-chief of the Daily Signal. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. Thank you, Noam Pikelny. Quite a banjo picker. All right, we've got Dr. Mark Muska in studio, and we're going to talk about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation coming up in about 9 minutes, just after the news. Good morning. It's 25 minutes till the top of the hour. You know, everybody wants affirmation in some form. Not me. You like me, though, don't you? Pastor Sam Crabtree says it's really not that difficult to find something to affirm in people.
I believe everybody's thirsty for affirmation. Everybody wants to be appreciated, even if you're not doing a completely successful job. I mean, the person who tries to bake a great dish for supper and it doesn't quite turn out, they at least want to be appreciated for the effort, for the try. If I look, I can find something that I can affirm in everyone, because everybody, saint and sinner, believer and unbeliever, everybody is made in the image of God. There's something of God in every individual. Flattery is an attempt to get something. Affirmation is a free-handed liberality that just gives it because it's right. It's good. I see what God is doing in you. I just want to enjoy it, call it out, say it, give him honor for it. And I hope you're energized by the affirmation also. It's just a gift.
If you want to hear that full interview from Pastor Sam Crabtree, go to myfaithradio.com and type in Sam Crabtree, just the way it sounds. Take a short break. Dr. Mark Muska in studio, professor of biblical and theological studies. We're going to talk about Martin Luther. Be back in a minute.
500 years ago, Martin Luther's passion ignited the flames of the Protestant Reformation. This is Jim Garlow. We often focus on October the 31st, 1517, when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the door in the Church of Wittenberg, Germany. And well, we should. But Luther had four great passions that explains the great changes he made. Sola Scriptura, by Scripture alone. Sola Christus, by Christ alone. Sola Gratia, by grace alone. And sola fide, through faith alone. As God's hand of grace and mercy moved through difficult events, sola scriptura, sola Christus, sola gratia, sola fide became the hallmark of virtually every Protestant group that followed Martin Luther. His theology corrected the church, putting it in a place to bless the rest of culture, to be God's instrument in saving civilization.
Twenty-three minutes until the top of the hour. Thank you, James Garlow. You just burned through my material. So now there's going to be a lot of awkward pauses. Well, not really. We've got Dr. Mark Muska in studio. Mark is a professor of biblical and theological studies here at the University of Northwestern. Here to talk about the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. 500 years ago, they were nailed to the door of the Wittenberg Castle, and I understand just last week they finished reading them.
Oh, it was actually quite a short notice.
Was it?
Right, yeah. You have to understand that in those days, the church door was kind of like the bulletin board for the community.
Sure.
And so Luther wanted to put these statements up there of things that he wanted discussed, theses, or a thesis, 95 of these. And most of them had to do with what he saw was injustices going on in the church over the collecting of what is sometimes called the collecting of indulgences.
Mm-hmm.
This was a practice that really was corrupted in the church at the time, where the church was able to sell for a price, you could petition the Pope to pray for your dead friends and loved ones who were in purgatory mm-hmm. at that time, and the Pope would pray so that they could be released to heaven to be with God for a small fee.
Isn't that just a clever campaign to build more churches and raise some money?
Well, sure to raise some money, sure. And whatever they did with that money, but it was Luther saw it as hateful.
Mm-hmm.
And using this kind of leverage against people and their sentiments toward their loved ones who have died. He had a great thing to say about that really deflated the balloon,
mm-hmm.
where he said, if the Pope of the Church is truly a compassionate and merciful God and a Pope, and if he has the ability to petition God so people can be released from purgatory, he'd do it immediately for everyone, and they'd mm-hmm. be released to heaven, and it wouldn't be any charge to it at all. And that kind of took the air out of the balloon.
I bet a lot of grieving widows and families were quick to make those indulgences.
You bet.
They were very happy to do it.
Yep.
I mean, quickly, I bet, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what else can we learn about Martin Luther and what he did?
Bill, you just can't underestimate the impact of this on not just the church, but Western civilization itself.
Yeah, I'm learning about that. That's fascinating.
It's really something because mm-hmm. so many forces converged at this time, and Luther was the man of the hour that was living at the right time for this. We can point to other people that lived before Luther that really could have been the leaders of this whole reformation of the church, and it wasn't the right time for it. And I'm thinking of one in particular, a Czech man by the name of John Hus. And he was martyred by the Roman Catholic Church before he could really carry out what he saw were needed reforms in the church as well. Mm-hmm. But several things came together for Martin Luther in the 1500s. In fact, people can appreciate this today as well, that technology played a huge role in this. Think of how our lives have been revolutionized in the last 20 years because of the internet and technology and now everyone with smartphones and all this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
The smartphone of the day in the 1500s was the invention of the printing press. And because of that, Luther's ideas were able to be copied and printed, and they spread all over Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't even possible a generation before that. So it was very much more difficult for the church to put down his ideas because they got distributed like that. I mean, think of that. Just a simple technological advance was contributed to the turning point in Western society this way.
It's amazing to think, Mark, that this conflict between the Protestants and the Catholics literally gave rise to science.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was another implication of this, that it rolled its way through literature, through the arts. This is the time when the Renaissance got fired up, and so we see this whole change in the contours in Europe and many different strands. I don't know if historians can really pull it together to explain it, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so many of these things that came together at once.
Mm-hmm.
But Luther himself was a remarkable guy.
Yeah.
My personal opinion about people is, Bill, that each of us has certain character traits, and those character traits can go really strong in the plus column to be really achievers or really have an impact on our world, and those same character traits can go to the dark side and be really bad.
Mm-hmm.
And Luther's a good example of this. He was someone who was driven, and he was not going to take no for an answer. A brilliant mind. He earned his law degree in the minimum amount of time required in his education, during his educational years. So this guy had a great force of mind and willpower, but he was also pretty cantankerous, and he didn't mind attacking the people he opposed, even fellow Protestants at times. He had nothing good to say about Ulrich Zwingli, the great Swiss reformer, those two. So Luther, I'm not ready to put a halo on him and say everything he did was good, but he's a remarkable guy for what he was able to do and the way he persevered. If I can give you just a little background of his life.
Please.
He was born in the 1400s, and he had set out to be a lawyer. And so he went through this training and earned his degree, a law degree. But then a real turning point in his life was in 1505. He was just a young man in his 20s. And he was caught in the middle of a lightning storm that terrified him. And in the midst of this, as a good Catholic, he prayed to one of the saints, Saint Anne, and mm-hmm. said, Saint Anne, save me and I'll become a monk. And he got through the storm, and he was conscientious enough to say that he followed through with his promise. Mm-hmm. It wasn't just a frivolous thing. And so he went and he became a monk. And he was, as far as monks are concerned, he was extremely effective and successful as far as his devotion and the energy that he devoted to this. I've got a quote here from Luther. He practiced all these ascetic things of going without sleep and eating terrible things, flagellating himself and all this kind of thing. And he commented later in his life, he said, if anyone could have earned heaven by the life of a monk, it was I, because he was so intense mm-hmm. on making himself acceptable to God. And especially it bothered Luther what Romans 1:17 says about that the righteous person shall live by faith. And for him, that bothered him because he saw his sin and how far short he fell. He knew that God was righteous, and he could not make himself righteous and acceptable to God. And he lived under this horrible guilt and shame of the guilt of sin until finally, when he was doing a study in the Psalms in the 1513, 1514 years, he was studying the book of Romans and studying the Psalms. And I've got this quote, very famous quote by Luther, where he says, at last, meditating day and night by the mercy of God, I began to understand that the righteousness of God is that through which the righteous live by a gift of God, namely by faith. Here I felt as if I was entirely born again and had entered paradise itself through the gates that had been flung open. His burden was released when he understood this, that righteousness was a gift that God gives us by faith. It wasn't something that we could earn. God doesn't have this brownie point system in heaven, mm-hmm. and he's not looking down at us, shaking his head with a frown on his face, mm-hmm. that he offers this gift of righteousness through Jesus Christ for us that we accept by faith. Wow. And that's just spectacular.
It is spectacular. We are sitting by the crackling fire with Brother Mark, so go get your cocoa. There's more to come. We'll take a short break and be right back. More with Dr. Mark Muska in just a minute. It's 12 minutes until the top of the hour. So glad you're with us today. I know you're enjoying this conversation with Dr. Mark Muska. And we're continuing our discussion about Martin Luther. And Mark, where do you want to start? The trial, or do you want to start at Romans 1:17?
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much we can talk about. It's mm-hmm. it's just such a captivating thing. I've got an eye for history. I love this stuff, to hear the lives of flesh and blood people and the things they faced and how they overcome and really made a society better. And so Luther, this is just something. When he started to, the 95 Theses led to other things where he started taking on the church, and it got him in trouble because of the hierarchy of the Catholic Church in particular. Luther was very famous statement. I don't have it word for word, but in essence what he said was, a common man with the Bible in his hands has more authority and accuracy than the Pope and all of his bishops. And wow. So you can imagine how that went over in Rome to hear that type of thing. And eventually he was commanded to appear before Charles V, who was the Holy Roman Emperor at that time. He was the king in Europe that was connected with the Catholic Church, and he thought it was going to be a debate of his ideas, but in fact it was a trial that they were conducting against him. And that would put a chill in your bones to mm-hmm. be brought to trial, because if you were found guilty of heresy and were unrepentant, did not recant, they would put you to death mm-hmm. as a heretic. And wow. this happened to many people in the history of the church. So Luther was on trial there for his ideas, but he refused to recant. And in fact, they asked him, will you recant? And his response initially was, let me think about it and give me 24 hours. And so he went and he prayed and he spent that night and he came back the next day. And his statement is a very famous statement that he gave to the council. I've got it here. He says that unless I can be instructed and convinced with the evidence from Holy Scripture or with open, clear, and distinct grounds of reasoning, then I cannot and will not recant, because it is neither safe nor wise to act against conscience. Here I stand. I can do no other. God help me. Amen.
Wow.
And fortunately, Luther had enough friends at that time where he was to be transported to another place, but he was, quote, kidnapped and taken to a castle where they protected him. I can't remember the name they gave him, but they gave him a euphemistic noble name.
Mm-hmm.
And he held out there at Wartburg Castle for 10 months, and that probably saved his life.
Wow.
They were not able to finish up their execution. And so his life was on the line. He was taking on the church. Thankfully, his ideas, though, did spread. There were other reformers around Europe. This thing caught fire, not just in Germany, but spread through. Many people aren't aware that one of the greatest fertile grounds for the Reformation was France initially.
Mm-hmm.
And if it wasn't for the Roman Catholic Counter-Reformation, it's sometimes called, later in the 1500s, France would have been a Protestant nation probably to this day. But the Counter-Reformation of the Catholics, where they brought their own reformations into the Catholic Church, it was swayed back to Catholicism. And so France's history remained Catholic. But through Amsterdam and into Great Britain, I mean, all over Europe there, these ideas spread, in particular in Switzerland. I already mentioned Ulrich Zwingli, and then, of course, John Calvin came another generation later and was a Swiss reformer as well. There was also Philip Melanchthon there in Germany with Luther that worked alongside of him. So this is like a brush fire that got out of control.
Yeah.
And the Catholic Church could not stamp it out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it just rolled over. But to talk about the political ramifications of this as well, you know, this was Europe had a political wedding with the church at that time, and you were supposed to submit to authorities and not take on. Even Luther had difficulty with this, where in a particular rebellion that was taking place, he took the side of the princes and said they should stomp out this rebellion. So he was working this out himself as far as the political implications and ramifications of what was happening in the church and how this thing, it was rolling faster than anyone could really control or even understand.
Mm-hmm.
of the implications.
Mark, who was the name of the Swiss reformer?
Well, there were a couple of them. John Calvin, of course.
Yeah, of course.
Then
the one before
Ulrich
that.
Zwingli.
Yeah, I don't know how to spell that.
Yeah, it starts with a Z. It's a Z-W-I-N-G-L-I.
Okay. I just learned how to say George Papadopoulos.
Isn't that great in the news,
so, yeah,
too?
Yeah, I mean, I can only do so much at once.
You don't want to stand too close to somebody when you say that. You'll spit all over them. But there was Luther and Zwingli met during the early years of the Reformation and they had a meeting at Marburg that was called, where they talked about their agreement, the things they could agree on, and they found that they agreed on almost everything, but the one thing they could not agree on and caused a clash and
mm-hmm.
a rift in the Reformation was the Lord's Supper and the presence of Christ in the elements of the bread.
Sure.
And the wine.
Yes.
That Luther stood on the idea that what Jesus said, "This is my body," where he declared that the presence of Christ himself, his body and blood, is in those elements of the Lord's Supper. And Zwingli would not accept that.
Mm-hmm.
He saw the Lord's Supper as merely a memorial
mm-hmm.
to the death of Christ, but there was nothing special about the elements themselves
mm-hmm.
when they were blessed. And to think that one issue took them away from each other, it was almost a foreboding of so much of the other schism and splits and separations that we've seen in the church ever
yeah.
since.
What did Jesus intend with the Eucharist, Mark?
Well, I think we can agree on some things. My approach, Bill, when you get into these debatable issues, is you don't start with the debatable stuff. You start with the stuff you can agree on. And I think all of us can agree that Jesus set up this memorial of the Lord's Supper so that we would never forget the significance of his death. Everybody remembers his death, but is it just a tragedy? Is it just too bad that Jesus was killed and he couldn't keep teaching love and peace and all this stuff? No, no, no. His death was intentional. Peter says in Acts 2:23 that this was according to the preordained plan and purposes of God that Christ was crucified. And why did he die? Well, just listen to what we say during the Lord's Supper. This is my body broken for you. Mm-hmm. He died for us, not mm-hmm. for himself. Mm-hmm. He was broken so our sins could be taken away and the penalty be forgiven. And then with the cup, he says, this is the cup of the new covenant in my blood. That statement, Bill, is so powerful if you unpack it.
It's amazing.
Because the new covenant he's talking about clearly revealed in Jeremiah 31, verses 31 through 34. Where Jeremiah writes, in these days I will make a new covenant with Israel and with Judah, not like the old covenant. I will change their hearts. I will write my law upon their heart. They won't have to even say anymore, know the Lord, because they all will know me. And then in verse 34 he says, and their sins and their lawless deeds I will remember no more.
Mm.
And then Jesus says he is bringing that covenant to bear in his blood. Anyone who understands Old Testament covenants, they were instituted through sacrifice,
right.
through blood.
Right.
And so Jesus right there is saying, here it is, changed hearts and forgiveness of sins, and I am doing it now through my death. So that's why we celebrate the Lord's Supper, is to remember this provides forgiveness of sin, peace with God, and to know God now through this. So that's why we celebrate this. And honestly, Bill, I think we got distracted off by this presence of Christ in the elements.
Yeah.
And sometimes it takes us away from this main thing that the Lord's table is all about.
Yeah, this is radio, so you can't see me doing this, but right now I'm placing 5 gold star stickers on Mark's jacket. Thanks a lot, Mark, for being here.
Sure.
It's 57 minutes after the hour. We'll take a short break and be back. Thank you so much, Dr. Mark Muska. But that was so interesting. I'm going to have to listen to that. We'll take a short break. Hour 2 is just around the corner. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.